Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Before we engage and turn the page and move to our review of Yahweh's presentation of himself and consider the foundation that we need to establish to understand his testimony, I want to leave you with the two lines, both of which are quoted from Wikipedia. Now, Wikipedia is not always the most reliable source in the world, but it is usually a reasonably reliable source of information as germane as what I'm going to share with you now. What I told everyone during the first hour of this show was that the god of the sheikh and sheikhism was indistinguishable from the man who conceived him, so that the guru Nanak was inseparable from his god. And that is the a statement I'd like to read from Wikipedia to affirm that what I shared with you is correct, that this god was made in a man's image. It reads, Guru is, which means teacher, it was the Guru Nanak. Guru is indistinguishable from God, and they are one in the same thing as God, which cannot be found apart from their wisdoms. So the wisdom of men, the insights of men, the guru who created the god, and the sheikh god are all indistinguishable. They are the same thing. The sheikhs believe that all subsequent gurus possessed Guru Nanak's divinity. The man who started the religion, who created this god, is believed to have been divine, and that they have usurped his religious authority. Religion is a bad thing, people. If anyone was informed and rational, the first thing they would say is, oh my goodness, why would anybody in their right mind believe such a thing? That is utter nonsense. But nonetheless, they do. Now, turning to information that we can use as a foundation for understanding that there is a God, and that that God did reveal himself to us, and that he can be known, and that he has made an offer to us of a relationship with him. I was in the last segment of our last program last week sharing two challenges of translation, because we need to understand they're going to be considering and how we convey what's on those manuscripts in English, which is the language of the Genesis Communication Network. The first thing I shared with you is that capitalization and punctuation do not exist in most ancient languages. They did not exist in ancient Hebrew. So we are adding punctuation and capitalization and the like so that it fits the grammatical style and presentation of English. Punctuation is somewhat guided by the Hebrew law, which typically introduces a new statement, thereby ending the previous one. The second was that in many ancient languages, and even many current languages, pronouns and conjunctions and tenses and the like are prefixes and suffixes to words, and so they must be separated in English for us to convey the thought being presented in one language in our language and be grammatically correct. As we go through Yah's testimony in his Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, one of the things I'm going to do with you is to share the Hebrew basis of the most informative words, because if I share them with you, then you have the opportunity to look them up for yourself in the dictionaries. And if you do, not only will you find verification, which will be reaffirming, but also questioning that leads to understanding. So the very act of you saying, I wonder if he is presenting this accurately, and you questioning it because it's not what you read in your translation of the Bible, that very questioning process is going to lead to understanding. And ultimately, if you test everything that I say and you verify it for yourself, ultimately you're going to come to trust the testimony of the God whose witness I will be sharing with you. Now, this brings us to the third challenge regarding Yah's testimony. That is completeness. Now, let me give you an example. Kara is one of the most common used verbs in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. It forms the basis of the mikra and mikre in the plural, which define the steps that we are asked to walk if we want to leave our mortal and polluted world and come into Yah's presence. But mikra can be translated a number of different ways. So it is most often translated called out or to call out. And being called out is an essential concept when it comes to Yah's testimony. That said, it means far more than to call out and call out. It also means to summon, to invite, to recite, to read. Kara also speaks of being welcomed into someone's company and meeting with them. Kara is such an essential verb in the Torah that when Muhammad created his Quran, which he said was pure Arabic, he named his Quran after this Hebrew verb. In fact, almost all of the key terminology in the supposedly pure Arabic Quran is Hebrew, not Arabic. Kara, meaning to recite, became the name of Muhammad's recital. So, Kara, to fully understand the verb, speaks of being welcomed into someone's company and meeting with them, literally being invited to meet with them, and coming to know them by reading and reciting their testimony. So, depending upon the context, Kara can be rendered many different ways, most of which are related, any one of which can apply. And so an amplified translation will try to err on the side of providing you with too much information rather than too little information, which will require greater focus on your part to understand, but a greater basis for understanding. And Kara is such a powerful term when you come to understand it. Now, it is so poorly and inadequately rendered in English in your translations and so inconsistently rendered, it would be very difficult for most people to get the true meaning out of the word. But it is something that is essential for us to understand. So we're going to really dig into the meaning of words so that we come to understand what is being conveyed to us. The fourth challenge to provide an accurate and complete translation is symbolism. For example, Oel is the Hebrew word for tent. But if this is all you read, you'd miss the fact that Oel is also a covering. It's a home. It's a shelter. It's a protected place suitable for living. And this symbolic implications are just the beginning. Oel is based upon, and in the text is written identically to, Ahal, which means to shine brightly, clearly reflecting light. Now, the reason that this is important is that the tent of the witness is a place for us to live. It's a place suitable for living. It's a place that is protected. It's a place where those who avail themselves of what is provided therein shine brightly, clearly reflecting the author's light, which is Yahweh's light. So like many Hebrew concepts, there are both physical and spiritual dimensions associated with the word. Therefore, rather than depicting a nondescript tent, the Oel, Ha'al, often represent a protective enclosure of radiant light, a shining shelter, a covering which is conducive to light, and a home which is associated with Yahweh himself and his family-oriented covenant relationship. As such, this radiant shelter is symbolic of the set-apart spirit's garment of light, which is something we will discuss at length in future programs. It is this garment of light which makes us appear perfect in God's eyes, enabling us to enter his presence and camp out with him on the mikra associated to tents known as sukkah, or shelters, which is the last step that we take if we wish to walk from our corrupted world, corrupted principally by religion and politics, to his perfect realm. Now, this leads us to the fifth challenge of translation. Now, I am sharing this with you, and I'm going to provide you with all of this, the background information as to why this isn't easy, for two reasons. One is I want you to to be inspired to question simplistic translations and those translations that you have, whatever your favorite version of your English Bible may be. I want you to recognize that they wrestled with all of these same issues, but they didn't bother to tell you about it. They want you to believe that their translation is inerrant, and I'm here to tell you that is just factually untrue. And it's important that you know that these choices have to be made. Now, this leads us to a fifth challenge, where we are compelled to consider every reasonable vocalization of each word. The diacritic markings are vowel points that were used in the Masoretic text are a product of rabbinical interpretation. They were not divinely inspired. This will be highlighted, in fact was highlighted, by our discussion of O-L versus A-A-A-L. You know, one means to radiate light, the other speaks of a tent, where the meanings were different, albeit complementary. In that vocalization influences most every word in the text, it is important that you realize that the rabbinical choices are often reasonable, but many times arbitrary, and sometimes perfectly and purposefully misleading. Now, while we're on the subject of vocalization, there is but one non-negotiable rule in a field of approximations where variant means to phonetically convey foreign words are all considered valid. Names and titles must always be transliterated. This is rule number one when it comes to translation. Names are always transliterated. Transliterated means we're going to replicate the sound of that name in the language that we are using, using our alphabetic characters to replicate the sound of the name. Words should always be translated. That means that we're going to use words in our language which best reflect the meaning of the word in the language we are translating out of. The only thing here that can be considered an option for transliteration or translation are titles. And we will return to the titles and how they are to be dealt with right after the break. This is Shattering Myths. Encourage your calls, 877-300-7645. Almost misled you there. 877-300-7645.
Day.
Good morning and welcome back to Shattering Myths. I am your host, Yada. You may call us if you'd like to engage in this conversation at 877-300-7645. We were talking about one of the challenges of translation, one of the rules of translation, and I'm going through this trying to lay down a foundation so that when we dive into to Scripture and you hear things that are inconsistent with your favorite variation of the Bible, you at least have the basis of saying, all right, now I understand why he is saying that and why I read this over here. And then by having this foundation, you yourself are put in a position where you can then do an investigation and determine which one you think is accurate. Now, we were speaking about vocalization, where I said that transliteration, which is replicating the sound in the new language, is how you treat names and usually titles. Although titles can be both transliterated and translated, is the best way to handle titles. Now, here's an example. We refer to the pharaoh Ramses. His name was pronounced Ramses in Egypt. His name is Ramses, and if you're speaking French, if you're speaking German, if you're speaking Arabic, if you're speaking English, his name does not change. It is Ramses. His title is Pharaoh. Genghis Khan is another example. It was Genghis Khan in Mongolia. It's Genghis Khan today. Der Führer, which is the leader, Adolf Hitler, that was Adolf Hitler was the man's name in German. It's the man's name in English. The Islamic jihadist Osama bin Laden is Osama bin Laden, and he is a jihadist. in every language. We do not change from one language or another. Similarly, the name and title of the Messiah, Yahusha, should never be altered, much less substituted for something of man's choosing. He is not Jesus Christ. He is the Messiah, Yahusha. Sixth, word order in Hebrew is less significant than it is in English and is often reversed. And that's common amongst many other languages. You know, rather than write Yahweh's Torah or set apart spirit, the text reads Torah, Yahweh, and Ruach Kodesh. Further, verbs don't always sit in the middle of the action as required in English between subject and object. So in the transition from Hebrew to English, one cannot slavishly follow the word order in the original language without confusing the listener. Now, as we go through the challenges on creating an accurate translation, our seventh challenge is a surprise to most, and that is that ancient and Paleo-Hebrew exist as an aspectual language. Now, what that means is that the same form of a verb can be translated as past, present, or future. Hebrew tenses are inclusive with regard to time. So while we can often deduce the proper tense based upon the context of a discussion as it relates to English, the realization that the message itself was not limited to a certain period of time makes everything God revealed applicable for everyone throughout time. Yahweh's word, like Yahweh himself, is always true regardless of time or place. Now, let me reemphasize that. There is no past, present, or future tense in Hebrew. Every verb in Hebrew simply exists. It was true, is true, and will always be true. And as such, if you don't have that mindset when you look at Hebrew as being very much like light, where time simply exists on light, if you run a photon of light, the past, the present, and the future exist simultaneously. It's how God proves his existence, because being like light, he has actually witnessed and participated in our future, and therefore can report to us in our past what will happen. He's not predicting the future. He's reporting future history. That's why only his prophecies are consistently accurate. Now, the eighth challenge to providing a complete and accurate translation lies in determining when enough is enough. This is a place where I often err by providing too much, mea culpa. The more completely each word is defined, the more nuances and shading which are conveyed, the more difficult each sentence becomes to read and to comprehend. After a while, it becomes information overload. So when a number of relevant insights exceed our ability to process them within the context of a sentence and still retain the flow and the substance of each discussion, we will color Yah's linguistic palette in subsequent paragraphs. So further recognizing the difficulty of processing such an enormous amount of information, I'm going to try to introduce spiritual passages in a way that you are grounded within the relevant context. This is Shattering Myths. We'll be back in a moment. Hello, welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're continuing to lay a foundation so that you are empowered to study Yah's testimony on your own and validate for yourself what you are hearing. Now, in this regard, what I'm going to share with you next may sound a little bit, you know, pedantic, and oh boy, we're getting way into the details. But I'm going to tell you what we're going to speak of here in a moment is really the thing that opens the floodgates of understanding. Now, in this regard, there is a very unique nature to Hebrew which does not exist in all other languages, does not exist, for example, in English. In Hebrew, there are stems, conjugations, and moods. And there is really no succinct way to communicate their contribution. Let me explain. A stem can be used, like the call stem, to necessitate a literal interpretation of what is being discussed, or a causal relationship. It can say, if you choose to value God, he will respond and value you. If you show interest in him, he will show interest in you. There, this is what we mean by a relational cause and effect stem. Another example is the conjugations. There are two congregations in Hebrew, the perfect and the imperfect. A great example would be the ten instructions that were etched in stone. God did not say that you can never commit adultery. He didn't say that you can never bear false witness. He did not say you could never kill. If he wanted to make a statement that was one and done, and if you did it once, you're guilty, and adios amigo, he would have used the perfect conjugation. That speaks of a completed and not ongoing action. But he didn't. He wrote all ten of the ten instructions in the imperfect. What that means is you should not continuously bear false witness. You shouldn't continuously commit adultery. You shouldn't make a habit out of killing. It is the kind of thing that a dad would say to a kid, you know, I know you're going to occasionally trip and do things that are not smart for you or for others, but just don't make a practice out of it. You know, learn from your mistakes. Don't continuously to do stupid stuff. And it's the very mentality of a God who provided instructions to us as opposed to one who had laws and commandments. So the ten statements etched in stone, they're not commandments, and they're not written in the perfect. They're written in the imperfect, recognizing we're imperfect. Just don't continue to kill. Don't continue to covet. The moment you stop killing, you're no longer in violation of the instruction. Powerful insights that can be derived from the conjugations. Now, the moods in Hebrew, they are also fascinating. Almost all Hebrew moods convey volition, which means they express a desire which is subject to choice. There's a first, second, and third person means to convey volition. Like somebody would say, Christians always say, I want to know what God's will is. Well, read his Torah, because lots of that he had to say in his Torah were written in the mood of volition, which expresses his desire, his will. His desire, his will is for us to shamar Torah, for us to observe his Torah, so that we come to understand who he is and what he is offering. And then many of the statements he makes to us are written so that we, the audience, the second person in this conversation, know that this instruction is being given to us, this guidance is being provided to us under the auspices of free will, where we are being given the opportunity to choose to embrace the advice, or we can choose to reject it. These moods convey so much which is essential for us to understand. So, collectively, these ideas are germane, this idea of volition and free will and choice, the idea of causal effect and relationships between objects and subjects tied to the action of the verb, and the fact we speak of ongoing things with unfolding consequences or a complete and total act. All of those things are essential and germane to our relationship with God. And none of them can be expressed in English as fluently as they are conveyed in Hebrew. But to ignore them, as virtually every English Bible does with almost every statement, is to not only shortchange the message, it's to diminish the amount that is being conveyed to the point where we understand maybe 5% of what was actually shared with us. Now, the ninth consideration is also surprising. Many of the best lexicons, that's a lexicon is where you would go, if I say Kara and you wanted to look up Q-A-R-A in your in a dictionary to find out what it means to say, is he accurately conveying its full meaning, which is to be, to invite, to summon, to read, to recite, to call out, to welcome and to meet and to greet, you would go to a lexicon, an English Hebrew lexicon, to look up the meaning of the word. Now, what's surprising to many is that the best lexicons were almost universally published by the very institutions which have published these horribly inaccurate Bible translations. And so in their lexicon, you'll see that they know what the word means, but in their translation, they have misrepresented it. Now, the only thing you have to be careful of here is that some lexicons were only created to justify the translation. For example, the Strong's lexicon, which is the most popular, was specifically created by Mr. Strong to justify the King James. And therefore, the first quote-unquote definition sometimes will be what is written in the King James, even though it isn't true. Now, that said, Strong's happens to be a valuable tool because Strong's, more than the other lexicons, actually works to present the roots of various words. And by studying the roots and words that are related, you come to a clearer and more complete understanding. And there are lexicons also that are filled with theological opinions, all of which you have to discard. Now, the tenth challenge is unlike the others. An accurate translation of Yahweh's testimony is so radically different than what is found in popular English Bibles, all of which profess to be the Word of God. Everything you're going to hear in this discussion will initially be difficult to accept. How is it, some will say, that an individual without professed qualifications could be right and every other translation could be wrong? Well, what I would hope that you would do is use this program and this foundation that you are being given to question both your translation and me. And then you will come to know why you can't trust your own English translation and how you can learn so much more when you have an open and questioning mind. Now, the answer to that question, how what I'm going to share with you, how it could be right and your translation is wrong, the answer to that question is typically motivation. The more English Bibles differ from what Christians have been accustomed to hearing, the harder they are to sell. I made a living in marketing, so I can tell you that familiarity sells. It's why, you know, Nike spends hundreds of millions of dollars getting people to wear their swoosh, because the more people are familiar with it, the more they will come to trust it. Familiarity is the key to marketing. If you were to try to publish an English translation of Yah's testimony that was accurate, no one would buy it because it would be unfamiliar to them. So rather than losing money publishing new translations of the oldest manuscript, the New King James Version, the New American Standard Version, the New International Version, and the New Living Translation, provide modest revisions of their own previous translations, which were simply stylistic interpretations of the King James Version to begin with. And the King James Version was nothing but a revision, five times older, of a translation of the Latin Vulgate, which itself was an amalgamation of old Latin texts based upon the Greek Septuagint, a highly unreliable translation of the original Hebrew text. So by the time you get to your NILT, your New Living Translation, it's had the Hebrew text filtered through the Greek Septuagint, feature filtered through and translated into old Latin, amalgamated by Jerome into the Latin of the Roman Catholic Church, and then translated by the likes of Wycliffe into a prototypical version of English, and then translated into the other languages of Europe, and then from there revised in terms of revisions of that, ultimately with the King James, for political reasons, trying to revise what was then called the Geneva Bible. So what you have is translations of translations of translations of translations, then becoming revisions of revisions of revisions of revisions of those translations. And every step along the way, something is lost. Now, from this point forward, all subsequent translations have become nothing more than financially inspired revisions. Specifically, the King James Version was a modest modification of the Bishop Bible, which was a revision of the Great Bible, which was amended from the Cloverdale Bible, which was a revision of John Wycliffe's translation of the Latin Vulgate, which was a blend of the old Latin texts, which were translations of the Greek Septuagint, which was then a translation of the Hebrew text. It's like kids, when you were a kid and you played the game of telephone, where a person whispers something in your ear and you start with a sentence, and the next person tells it to the next person who tells it to the next person down the chain, and by the time you've gone through five people, it only barely resembles what was originally said. Well, that's what happens when you produce a translation of a translation five times over and a revision five times over of those translations. What comes out at the other end barely resembles what was originally said. Now, the bottom line in all of this is marketing, especially publishing religious text, is that familiarity sells. As a result, every popular modern Bible translation is similar to every other popular Bible translation, because had they not been similar, they would have not become popular. So their similarity shouldn't be surprising. Bible translations are all style over substance. And their authors have no compunction against changing God's testimony to suit their religion. Now, many have sought to dismiss the translations that I'm going to be sharing with you with an uninformed, "I can't believe that God would allow his Bible to be corrupted." And at that point, they just stop thinking. They are saying, in essence, that the translation they prefer is perfect. And yet, to hold this view, one enormously popular through Christendom, a person has to ignore an ocean of irrefutable evidence to the contrary. Moreover, God himself told us that men and women would pervert his testimony. He even revealed the consequence of our corruptions. So we'll return to this discussion after the break. This is Shattering Myths, 877-300-7645. Shattering myths. We are in the midst of shattering one of the most pervasive myths, particularly among Christians. And so I'd like to take a step back and take a run at this a second time here and convey more information that helps you absolve this issue that the Christian mindset is that I can't believe that God would allow his Bible to be corrupted, which says in essence that the translation that they are holding is the inerrant word of God. And I'm here to tell you it isn't even remotely accurate. I don't care what translation they're holding, it isn't even remotely accurate, much less perfect. And yet, the simple statement, "I can't believe God would allow his Bible to be corrupted," for the religious, wipes that whole issue and mindset away. And that is the place where we need to understand, if we're going to be rational, that making a statement does not make that statement true, no matter how many people say it. For example, all the evidence is to the contrary. 100% of the documented and historical evidence shows that there have been more corruptions of Yah's testimony than there have been accurate transmissions of it. Also, God himself told us that men would pervert his word. His Torah prophets and even Yahusha's testimony is replete with examples of this very thing occurring and delineating the consequence of twisting, perverting, and corrupting his word. In Yirmiyahu, for example, which you'll find is corrupted to Jeremiah in your Bible, Yahweh tells us that the copy edit whereby his name was replaced with the Lord in his word is the single greatest crime ever perpetrated by mankind. I mean, there can be no more blatant and bold presentation of God saying, "Yeah, I'm going to allow you, because of free will, to corrupt my testimony, but I'm going to hold you accountable and I'm going to warn you about it." And the place where he draws the line in the sand is that this is the single greatest corruption and copy edit ever perpetrated was the replacement of my name, Yahweh, with the Lord. And yet that is what you will find in virtually every English Bible translation. Now, if you choose not to believe Yahweh on this, as is the case for most Christians, what about the evidence? Well, for this religious myth to be plausible, that God would not allow anyone to corrupt his word, there could be no divergent parchments among the 215 scriptural manuscripts found in the cliffs above Qumran, collectively known as the Dead Sea Scrolls, dating from 250 BCE to 68 CE. And yet, the small differences we find among them are magnified exponentially by the time these texts reemerge under the auspices of the Masoretic text. Septuagint copies dating from 2 BCE to the 5th century CE differ so wildly that in the 3rd century CE, Origen, one of the few early theologians to study Hebrew, was compelled to dedicate most of his life just to trying to resolve the conflicts between them, creating his hexapla, which unfortunately has been lost to time. If God had intervened to keep his scriptures from being corrupted, both the Septuagint and the Masoretic texts, dating the Masoretic itself, dates to the 11th century CE, would have mirrored the Dead Sea Scrolls. And yet that is not what the evidence reveals. These texts differ by as much as 20%. Now, turning to the Greek text, the situation only gets worse, much worse, which is catastrophic for the Christian myth of godly protection and inerrancy. The 69 pre-Constantine manuscripts, the codices, which have now been unearthed, differ substantially among themselves. This variance then becomes irresolvable. The 3rd century textual witnesses are compared to those scribed in the wake of Catholicism's emergence in the 4th century, with their remarkably divergent Codex Sinaiticus and Vaticanus. And yet the biggest discrepancy of all exists between these manuscripts and the fraud known as the Textus Receptus, which was acclaimed as being without error by the religious community in the 16th century. However, the known disagreements between it and the older codices have now been shown to exceed 300,000 differences in a document that is only 182,000 words long. More discrepancy than there are words. Well, here we are about shattering this. We'll continue to do so in our program tomorrow. We hope that you join us. I am your host, Yada. And tomorrow, call us at 877-300-7645. Jot the number down and use it to engage in this conversation. May Yah bless.